And as you say, my title is there, Sex and the Planet. Rumours of my retirement are exaggerated. I'm still active. I used to run the Margaret Pike Family Planning Clinic in London, which is the biggest family planning clinic in the country. I now don't do that, but I'm still involved at the Elliott Smith Clinic at the Churchill Hospital here in Oxford, where we're doing research into a new male pill, the world's first non-hormonal male pill in the pipeline. So at the end, if you're interested, ask me questions about that, but it's not the topic of the day. The fuller title I've got is here. Sex. Is this the most dangerous human activity for humans themselves and ultimately all life on Earth? And some of you will get the explanation for why that's a truth. The answer to that question is probably yes already, but certainly, hopefully, by the time I finish, you will agree with what I'm saying. Sex is the first word in the title, and so let's start there. It's important to all of us, all our lives. It is, of course, I shouldn't be talking about it being dangerous. It's also something that is capable of giving the highest pleasure that a man and a woman can possibly have in a good relationship. And it goes on and on. And I've got a lovely little interview here. I'm not sure whether this is the Oxford Mail and Times interviewing this chap, but he was called Henry, and he's 80, and he's on his 50th wedding anniversary, and he's asked by the journalist, "How do you think you've managed to keep so sprightly?" Responds 80-year-old Henry, "Sex, nearly every day. Nearly on Monday, nearly on Tuesday, nearly on Wednesday." So it's important to us, and don't let's run it down and say it's not, it's terrible. It isn't. Of course it's not. It's fantastic. But, and the but comes now, there are direct dangers, even especially to somebody like Henry. Because you can get a heart attack or a stroke, especially if you're an older man. There's a direct danger of sex. There are sexually transmitted infections, which again is another whole subject which we're not going to deal with today, but those are dangerous and connected with sex. Otherwise, the direct risks apply primarily to uncontracepted sex, and unfairly, they apply mainly to women. And now I'm talking about maternal mortality, which is vast around the world. In this country, very few women die in childbirth. But in the world, something like just coming up to 1,000 a day of women are dying. And research shows that a lot of these women are being died of a pregnancy they wouldn't choose to have had in the first place had they had access to the family planning that we take for granted. So uncontracepted sex in many settings in the world is highly dangerous. And of course, 47,000 of those 1,000 a day die from unsafe abortions around the world. From unsafe abortions, of which there are about 20, 25 million. There are about 40 million plus abortions take place in the world every year, and about half of them are in unsafe contexts. Maternal morbidity, which is being made ill or injured, as opposed to actually dying by being a sexually active woman, is actually 20 times higher than maternal mortality. And the nastiest of all, the morbidities, of course, is vaginal fistula. You've heard of this, have you? Where the woman, after prolonged obstructed labour in the African continent in particular, gets leaking urine or sometimes faeces as well, and becomes ostracised, a pariah in her own community. And it's, again, very often and sadly the case, that she didn't want the pregnancy that caused this in the first place. You can't die or get a smelly fistula from a pregnancy you don't have. It's hardly rocket science. And it's tragic that so many women around the world are being put in that position for lack of what we, in a rich country like this, take for granted, which is the choice to go to bed with your partner tonight, have some good sex, but not necessarily have a baby. And you could add to this final list, the final item on the list of the risks of uncontracepted sex, the risk of infant mortality, because infant mortality has been shown to be lowered if the children are well spaced. Look at the next slide here. This is from the Save the Children Fund. And if you have your babies less than 2 years, you have approximately double the likelihood of the second child dying than if you have your baby spaced by 3 years or more. How do you do it? By contraceptive sex. So uncontraceptive sex kills millions of babies all the time by this lack of spacing. And indeed, the first baby also suffers if the children are too close together. And this is a lovely little booklet I picked up recently from Save the Children Fund, who, let me give them a plug here, are a development charity that really understands the importance of family planning. And I think one of the tragedies of Oxfam here in this town is that it doesn't, or hasn't in recent years, seen how important family planning is for relief of poverty and relief of a lot of misery around the world. And if you look at the bottom corner here in this Save the Children booklet, it says, no child born to die. Think about it. No child born to die. That's a good statement. So here are the direct dangers. What now? And that's the topic of the rest of my talk. What are the indirect dangers of uncontraception? Well, here they are, folks. The population problem. We haven't quite reached this situation yet, but we are an amazingly successful species. We can live in all parts of this planet of ours, in the cold and in the remote north and in the heat of the equator. Unlike any other species, we are so clever we can adapt everywhere. But we have spread all around. And the number we have reached now is 7,000 million. Do you know how long it takes to count to 1 billion, 1,000 million? If you just take a second on each number, and if you think of the nine-figure numbers involved, it would take you a second to say them aloud. It takes you 31 years and 7 months to count to 1 billion. We have 7 billion. And we're rising at the rate of 80 million a year, approximately. Different figures come along. And that is the equivalent of the population of Germany or the population of Egypt arriving every single year. There is no way this process could possibly be sustainable. It is out of the question if you look at this little visual here, going up at that rate of 87 million per year. Another way of looking at it, of course, is the fact that we humans don't just arrive. We make demands on this planet of ours. We have footprints. And it is a scary thought that a greenhouse gas-producing city for 1.5 million people arrives in the world somewhere every week. Just stop and think about that. Since last Tuesday, a city for 1.5 million has had to be created somewhere. And by next Tuesday, another. And then think what a city does. How the land it takes up itself, its immediate footprint, but the surrounding footprint in terms of cropland, the need to destroy forest around so that you can grow your crops, the destruction of habitats, and the production of greenhouse gases, even by a poor city, even if it's a lot less than a rich city, there still has to be energy. The good news, every year, more people are reducing their carbon footprint. The bad news, every year, more people. Two things go together, folks. It's not either or, it's both and. I'll come back to that point later. And population is the great driver of most of the world's greatest challenges, great 21st century challenges. Read them for yourselves on the slide. I could argue, if we had a lot more time, every single one of those is worsened, potentially, by increasing humans on the planet, by uncontracepted sex. And you've probably heard of the Millennium Development Goals, the MDGs, which were set up in the year 2000, meant to be achieved by the year 2015, which is only 3 years' time. And they're meant to have a dramatic reduction in poverty and hunger, increase in education, gender equity, reduce child mortality, reduce maternal mortality, reduction in killer diseases, and increased environmental sustainability. And again, every one of those MDGs, it is very, very easy to argue, can be made easier if we have in the world more uncontraceptive sex. Let me just give you an example. Education. Think about it. It's hard enough educating the planet we've got. There's a huge shortage of education in the country where I was born, which is Burundi, in the middle of Africa. or in Uganda or Kenya, where I went to school. But in the world, we need an extra 2 million teachers every year with class sizes of 40. Think about it, that's what 80 million means extra every year, just to keep steady on the education front. So all the MDGs are made more difficult by this subject of increasing numbers of humans uncontracepted sex. I have not seen a world problem that wouldn't be easier to solve with fewer people, or harder and ultimately impossible with ever more. That's what the patron of an organization I'm also a patron of, called Population Matters, has recently said, Sir David Attenborough. Now let's just take one of the things that was on that white slide just now, the greenhouse effect and climate change. You know about this, there's a picture that displays what's going on. Do you know that decade on decade, 1980s was the warmest decade on record of the time, 1990s the warmest record on time, and then the 2000s have been even warmer. Every year, warmer than the 1990s average. So climate change denial is just nutty. It really is. It is happening. You can argue about how much humans are causing it, but you can't argue about the facts. And things like extreme floods, which are connected, but of course also hurricanes and excessive heat, etc., and fires in Texas and Spain and elsewhere, and Greece. Did you notice just 2 weeks ago that the Greenland ice sheet has shrunk more this summer than ever before? Is this the future? We tend to think, oh, Greenland's miles away, Africa's miles away, the Maldives are miles away, they're going underwater. But it's possible that it'll come much closer to home as a consequence of climate change. So that, again, is worsened by the number of climate changers. We talk about environmental footprints. We also need to talk about the number of feet doing the footprinting. I mentioned earlier, with that image of the city arriving every week, that we destroy habitats. That's the main way we kill beautiful species we share the planet with. It's not so much shooting rhinos for their horns. It is just inadvertently destroying the habitats. And we're aware of this happening in this country. Again, today's news, 100 highly endangered species, debate on Radio 4 this morning. Are we going to try and save them all? Or shall we have to decide we can't save them all? These are all endangered species. The sixth great extinction is going on, folks. It's the very first of all those in the geological record where one species is causing the destruction of the others. The other extinctions were all caused by cataclysmic geological events. Here's a different thing caused by too much uncontracepted sex by one species. Wild species are now only 3% of vertebrate flesh on the planet. That is the scariest statistic I think I'm going to give you today. Imagine that. If you were a giant and could put all the human flesh and all our cows and all our sheep and all our pigs into one side of the scales and then put all the wild creatures on the other, it would be 97% is human flesh plus our cows and pigs, etc. And only 3% left that is wild. 10,000 years ago, it would have been completely the other way around. And of course, some species are far more important than others. And if we were to destroy our pollinators, like the bees, which are under threat, then that would be really scary. So I've got now a couple of little video clips. What you have here is a picture of the world, little signs coming up of what's going on at the time, and every dot on the map is a million people, and all you hear in the soundtrack is a heartbeat. At this point, total population of the planet, probably about 500 million. Mostly concentrated, interesting enough, like now, in two countries, but also in Europe. You may say, what's happening in North America or in Australia? They did have some people, yes, but you haven't got a million. You only get a dot when there's a million people. Here you'll notice a few dots disappearing. especially in Europe. This is where doctors and nurses come into the picture with improved public health in the middle of the 19th century, and that's when it really takes off. Wait and see. Every dot, a million people. Always puts my own heart rate up, that. A billion extra people, think of that, 31 years it takes to count, have arrived since 1999, in just 11 years, 12 years, a billion in that time, in all our lifetimes in this room. Every 11 years or so we get about a billion extra. And of course, as you saw from my footprint slide, it isn't just that we come along, it's what we do when we come along. It's the impact we have on this beautiful planet, the footprints as well. So now my next little video clip comes into the picture. And think of this next clip in context of the number of humans. It's the whole thing put together. It's called The Impossible Hamster. The Impossible Hamster.
From birth to puberty, a hamster doubles its weight each week. If it didn't stop when mature, as animals do, and continue to double, on its first birthday, we would be staring at a 9-billion-ton hamster. This hamster could eat all of the corn produced annually worldwide in a single day and still be hungry. Size only to a certain point. So why do most economists and politicians think that the economy can grow forever and ever and ever?
You can get this for yourselves at theimpossiblehamster.org or on YouTube. And of course, it talks about the economy there, but the economy doesn't exist in a vacuum, does it? The economy requires the environment, requires resources, and requires the creation of pollution. And too many of us are doing this. And you think of climate change as a pollution effect because of carbon dioxide. But of course, in many ways, some of us are more frightened of the loss of resources at the other side, eating up what the planet's got available. And it's these three arrows put together that are so scary. Such that John Beddington, the government's chief scientist until a few years back, said, growing world population is going to cause a perfect storm of food, energy and water shortages in the world by 2030. The demand will create a crisis with dire consequences. And he's no fool saying that. We're talking here, folks, today, not my opinion, or anybody's opinion. We're talking stark, scary facts on a finite planet, because it is finite. 70% of our planet is salt water. Half of the rest is mountain or desert. We cannot go on, folks, the way we are. It is patently unsustainable. And if there's going to be this shortage of resources, I call it resource shortages are always caused, actually, by people longages. Never said, but resource shortages are caused by people longages. And this people longage problem is going to cause the other thing, more and more violence on the planet. It has to. As we fight over the last drops of oil and shale oil and everything else that's going along those lines, as we fight over water and so on. So, in many ways, this is not a bundle of laughs, folks. We are faced with a very stark dilemma. In the not-so-distant future, I used to be talking, when I began this road, way back when I was a medical student, wasn't sure what branch of medicine to take up, and as a consequence of a lecture a bit like this, same sort of number of people, I decided that the most important branch of medicine was family planning, because I was so scared. No surprise that the lecturer was a biologist. And if the world was run by biologists rather than by economists and sociologists, we'd have woken up sooner to the finiteness of our planet. And any environment cannot go on receiving users of that environment indefinitely. So what are we going to do, folks? It's pretty stark. The ultimate inconvenient truth, you know Al Gore's movie, the Inconvenient Truth, the ultimate inconvenient truth is here. The planet is finite. Sustainability will happen. No debate. It's only a matter of how we do it. And part of how we do it has to be by family planning on the left. Otherwise, if we don't, the standard ways nature has of bringing the population back into balance will simply happen. Increasingly on the right, coupled with the extra things that climate change is bringing along, like the hurricanes and the floods. And yet, isn't it true? What I've been talking about for the last 20 minutes is the elephant in the room that nobody will talk about. And it becomes a taboo subject. People don't want to talk about it. We're having a grown-up adult discussion about something which most people out there who are like us, middle class and wanting not to offend anybody, will steer clear of. We don't want to get into it, do we? But we must. Our children will not forgive us if we don't have a grown-up discussion about what we're going to do about this. I think part of the problem is the very words population control. And except in the context of this particular slide, you will never hear me put those two words together. And I haven't for decades now. Because that combination of words is the problem. People think that you're going to be Big Brother, you're going to force people, you're going to coerce them like China to have fewer children. Actually, it's a win-win thing. If you go there to poor settings, as I know well from my experience in Africa, and remove the barriers to contraception, people want it and will use it. And there's no need to coerce anybody. And if you remember my very first slides, you then have the win-win situation of also improving maternal mortality, infant mortality, all these other win-win things on top. But please, will you never say this? If anybody in your hearing from today, the 11th of September, 2012, if anybody in your hearing ever says population control, please join me in biting their heads off. I mean it, because those two words have done endless damage to the cause. Because as soon as you say the very words, people think of India in the 1970s, of China today. They think you're going to push instead of making people have choices, opportunities, which is what it's about. But I said it's not a bundle of laughs, this talk. And before I get a bit more empowering, a little bit less depressing, did you know that Edvard Munch's picture was actually an environmental picture? I paused, feeling exhausted. This is what he's written in this version of the painting. I leant on the fence. There was blood and tongues of fire about the blueback fjord and the city. My friends walked on and I stood there, trembling with anxiety. And I sensed an infinite scream passing through nature. Isn't what I've been saying for the last little bit just about that? An infinite scream passing through nature. All the other species, the millions, 10 million or so that we share this planet with, screaming. Humans, you say you're so clever. Can't you do something about your own selves and not make life so miserable for us? This is the year in which we remember the tragedy of the Titanic. But would you not agree, in the context of the last 20 minutes, most of what we see on television, most of what we hear in the news, is like rearranging the deck chairs, fiddling while Rome burns. Nobody imagines how quickly things are going to go pear-shaped, really pear-shaped. We used to talk, as I said earlier, about our grandchildren's lifetime, and then of our children, now it's children's lifetime, possibly even our own lifetimes. Things are happening. 2030 was the year that Buddington said was going to be everything going pear-shaped. That's mighty soon. If you want to know why I show this little clip, this is the point at which I get off my soapbox, and why we start to be a little bit more positive, a little bit more empowering. And don't worry, penguins love ice cold water. So there's nothing wrong with what you see here. By the way, I'm sorry about my voice. I'm just getting over a cold. Can you still hear me all right? It's still just about surviving. How do you like that? How do you like this one? And you know, of course, that those cars I was talking about earlier do produce greenhouse gas, which is 21 times more powerful than CO2. There we go. This is just to lighten the touch slightly. And now let's be more positive, because we're not dead yet. We may have missed lots of opportunities. People have not been listening to the few people like myself and others who, for the last 40 years, have been saying things have got to change. But we still are not quite dead yet. There's lots that can be done. But let's not go silly and just talk about one side of the coin. I am not a populationist, folks. I'm an environmentalist. It's just that you have to think of two sides of a coin, and some would say three. Basically, on the right, overconsumption of resources. And you see in the corner there, I've said five R's. The five R's are to refuse to do the bad things, to reduce when you can't refuse, to reuse, repair, recycle, and bicycle. I heard that most of you came on bicycles today. There's my Brompton. So that's a little mantra we should teach all our kids. Do you do this? Teach your children and your grandchildren, refuse, reduce, reuse, repair, recycle, and bicycle. And I'm just as enthusiastic about that side of the coin as I am about the family planning side of things. We need to do both things here. Accessible family planning, removing the many barriers to women which exist out there that stop women who would otherwise use family planning using it, and each of us living more equitably with smaller footsteps. It is an issue of equity. This country requires 3.6 times its land area to live the way we do. Where's that coming from? From other poor people around the planet. It is unfair. We should live within our resources as an island, as islands. 3.6 times our land area is our footprint as a nation. That's me at the Blenheim Brompton World Championships, which took place last August, just gone by. Okay, so it's both sides of the coin. As I'd like those of you who've got it in front of you to look at my little abstract. There's a sheet of A4 there you've got. And the second paragraph, just fish out this white sheet, my abstract. And let me just read this to you. Ehrlich and Holden showed there are only three factors or drivers of human environmental impact. The greenness or otherwise of technology, that's the T factor, on average, per person. Ongoing resource consumption and pollution, again, per person. And the number of persons. End of story. There are no more factors than those three. And the first two factors are well recognized in determining environmental footprints. But there are, as I say, insane taboos that inhibit adult discussion about the number of feet during the footprinting. Now this, of course, actually ties in with that here, because the overconsumption of resources, when you open it up, is actually two things. It's all of us living the wrong kind of lifestyles, overconsuming, we've got to consume less, but it's also greener technology. And I'm a great enthusiast of technology. Wonderful, let's have better technology. But you know the greenest form of energy of all? It's the energy you don't use at all. And that's where we're wasting so many opportunities in terms of technology again to help us to use less energy. Anyway, so there is a connection. We're talking about two sides of the same coin. or attacking three factors, two of which are linked on one side of the coin and the other on the other. And the silly thing is, all this talk for the last 15 years since climate change first became a public issue has been about A&T, and far too little about the P factor. I'm not saying it's the only factor, but it surely deserves addressing if there are only three. And yet, in Rio de Janeiro, big conference just happened in June about the future of the planet environmentally, population not talked about. Elephant in the room. I'm embarrassed because when I went to that lecture as a medical student, I can see how, as a doctor, we actually cause the problem. Because there are loads of myths out there, and one of the myths is that population growth is due to a rise in birth rates. Not so. It's due to us doctors and nurses bringing in, for the first time, the removal of the pump. You remember Sir John Snow, Dr. John Snow, who removed the handle of the Soho pump, and he's credited with being the founder of modern public health. And then, 100 years later, penicillin came along. And these things created an imbalance. In Africa, you had to have about 8 kids to get 2 to survive with the high death rates. We doctors came along, and as a completely inadvertent side effect of a really good thing we did, we created a massive imbalance because people went on having the birth rate high, and we now had far greater survival. I'm not saying we did a bad thing, but we should have realized the need quicker to do something about addressing the imbalance that we, medical people, had caused inadvertently. You see, the world family planning family size has come down. When I embarked on this road, the average family size of the world was 5.2. That was the normal average around the whole world, developing plus developed. It is now 2.5. So we've done something, folks. We've got quite a lot of the way. But the problem is the countries here where there is a brown or darker colours of red, which are much higher family, much larger family sizes. And of course, then you have a bulge of children and you have a population momentum, which is why the country I went to school in, Uganda, is destined to triple its population by 2050, just in the next 40 years. Half of Ugandans, when you walk through the streets of Uganda, are not grown-ups. Half of all Ugandans are aged under 15. That's the legacy of past large family sizes, even if they do, hopefully, make them much smaller in future. And essentially what I'm talking about is a youthquake of young people. We're pretty useless at avoiding teenage pregnancy, even in this country. And if you ever wanted me back again, I could give you a spiel on avoidance of teenage pregnancy in the UK, Rachel. It's one of my other subjects. And look at the next slide, the next cartoon. It makes us laugh, but it should make us cry that there are any 12-year-old mothers in the world, and there are a lot in both rich and poor settings. And it's a sign, again, of the need for more contraception out there. If you want to read more about that youthquake, I've written this little PDF booklet, which you can get from the Optimum Population Trust website, which is the same as Population Matters, and discusses this whole issue of the demographic momentum that is forcing us to accept at least another 2,000 million people before we could ever reach stability. I'm nearly finished now, Rachel. I know I've slightly overdone, but I won't be long now. There are many myths. I've addressed some of them already. The myth that it is higher birth rates. The myth that poor people are having lots of sex. They don't have any more sex than we do. It's just they don't have the choice to not have the children that result. There's a very strong myth out there that people in developing countries go out deliberately to have a large family so that they can be looked after in their old age and so that as to replace the high child mortality. There's some truth in that, but they're still forced by their biology to have much more than they would need for that purpose, and they realise that themselves. It is not, as is the perceived wisdom, that that's the problem. What it is, actually, is back to my title. It is sex. Who of you in this room who had 2, 3, or 4 children had sex just twice, or three times, or four times. I don't see any hands going up. We love it. We do it all the time. And as a consequence, we're absolutely bound, whether we're rich or poor people, to have large families. That is the default state of humanity. To have 10 kids. That is normal. You only will be able not to have that large family if you remove the barriers to women so that they have access to the methods of family planning and the correct information they need to choose to use it. And when you do that, in every country where this has been done, you find the family size goes right down. Other myths connected with this, that anybody who has a quantitative concern about human numbers, that must be intrinsically coercive. I hope I've already scotched that. Or that anyone who's worried about this issue is about family planning, you're going to be exclusive. You're either going to be coercive or you're going to be exclusive of other things. You're just going to give them condoms and not give them food and health care. I never said that. And yet that's what's so often said about those of us who are worried about family planning. Why can't you say family planning is important as well? And mean as well. And be heard as well. And not be heard by Oxfam and others as instead. In the case, it's as well. As well. And when it is as well, and when it's available in a non-coercive way, there are dozens of countries, Colombia, Costa Rica, Cuba, Iran, Taiwan, South Korea, even Kerala within India, where family sizes came down, the total fertility rate came down in the same time as China to half what it was before without any of the coercion of China. What did they do? They opened the door to women. They removed the barriers, made the methods available. These are the methods, not that one. This is what happens with uncontracepted sex. We like to do it. But these here, are the methods of family planning, which we in the UK are lucky enough to be able to use. There are about 15 different methods there. It's not just the pill, there are injections, there are IUDs, there's a whole range of methods that can be used. Our sisters in Africa and South Asia have access, if they're lucky, to about 3 of those. And even then, they're often stopped by their partners from going out to get them. It's too expensive, or the supply chain dries up. Endless barriers. The Pope's in the way. You could list a huge list of barriers. And yet we have this amazing scientific advance. I say, thank God for contraception. Why can't we blazon the broad? Scientific technology that allows humans to have our orgasms without having more babies than either we can properly look after or the planet can handle. Where this has been done, where the methods have been available, barriers removed, and you've removed particularly the education barrier and informed people about the options and corrected a lot of misinformation I find in Africa, that people think if you go on the pill, you're going to be made sterile. That's a very powerful myth, that hormonal methods like the DEPO will make you sterile. And these methods are very tragic in their effects, but if you correct the misinformation using the mass media in particular, as well as education, then look at the dramatic effects you're going to have without a hint of coercion at all. I'm afraid you have humans. Overconsumption, and already too many. What can we do? Well, on the tables there are some leaflets for Population Matters, and I'd love it if at least 1 in 5 of you would consider joining our little group. We only had 200 members 10 years ago. We're now over 3,000 and rising all the time. And we need more people. Is it?
It's ironic.
Yeah. Well, not by multiplication, but we're in the business of advocacy, and the more of us advocates, the better. I hope you agree. And you can join on the website, which is £22. These are very important websites, Population Media, talking about using entertainment education within the storyline to tell people in poor settings how valuable it will be to use family planning. And this Save the Children I'm singing the praises of among the development groups. And finally, Spike Milligan said it, contraception should be used on every conceivable occasion. And it would be lovely if this whole planet of ours, all the children arrived by caring choice rather than by careless chance, which is often the only way it can happen. So thank you very much for attention, folks.
Thank you very, very much indeed, John. We're going to take about 5 minutes break. I'm on my own tonight without my student helpers. None of them are back yet, they're still on holiday. So could you please help yourselves to wine, food, a few more nibbles still left, squash, water, things like that. As Emma said, the loser by the stairs, if anybody needs them. If somebody agile who's willing to gallop around with a microphone would like to volunteer to help you after the break, that would be great. And in the meantime, thank you very much again, and see you in a few minutes.
Yes, good. You know that.
Shall I carry him right?